Ladies and gentlemen, it's Beyond Casterbis. I'm Christian Crawley. This is James McLean. How are you, James?
Good, thank you.
Good. We're going to talk about Star Trek Discovery, which is airing on the what's the station called? CBS
Online, isn't it? CBS Online.
Is that what it's called? CBS Online.
I'm pretty sure it was something really uncatchy.
Yes, that was exactly CBS All Access. CBS All Access. Star Trek Discovery, which it's a brand new way of doing Star Trek. And we were talking about this a few days ago about how Star Trek should probably go in a different direction, weren't we? We were thinking maybe, you know, like a colony situation, because we've had like a space station situation.
Oh, yes,
Lost ship. We've had the ships exploring. And the name Starship Discovery, which has probably the worst acronym in the entire history of TV shows.
For British people.
Well, for British people mainly, yeah. STD, yes.
Yeah. Star Trek Infection would be the worst one for American audiences.
Yes, indeed, yeah.
On both levels.
Yes. Although I suppose they did that with Star Trek Insurrection, didn't they?
Yes, that is true.
So, yeah. I've completely lost my thread. But yeah, this does attempt to do a new thing with Star Trek. So I think that much. I mean, I've watched the first three episodes. James, you've watched the first two episodes. I think as what we've probably both seen indicates that this is a different take on Star Trek. Where do we really start about? Where we should start is the opening titles.
Okay.
Actually, because that's at the beginning of the show. I was surprised at how. Because there is a way of doing Star Trek titles that people know about, and then there's the Star Trek Enterprise way of doing titles, which is a bit 80s. And then there's this way of doing. I like this opening title sequence, and I like the theme tune.
It's very very Netflix, isn't it?
It is very Netflix, yeah.
Sort of along the lines that you'd see from Marvel's co-ops with the Daredevil, Jessica Jones. It's got that sort of very arty, organic vibe to its opening sequences. I like the opening sequence, yeah. I thought it was quite nice.
I think as well, when you're seeing the various items being designed and you see some of them you see them put together, another one like the phaser gun, another one like the communicator, you see them, it's just there and then it's sort of like phase, and then you see the two space suit hands about to touch, like Michelangelo's God and Adam.
Yeah.
Which is nice. I think as well, you're left in no doubt. I suppose it depends what you know about Star Trek. But you're left in no doubt where this show is kind of situated in the vague Star Trek chronology when you see all these pieces of equipment, don't you?
Yeah, I still don't understand why it has to be in the Star Trek chronology anyway. That just confuses me.
Yeah.
I just, why they just can't, why they, I mean, let's go, I mean, I think a good example of this is, what was it, they did, with Doctor Who, they did a survey for the new Doctor, and I think they came up with something, I can't remember where this is sourced, so people better check this, but something like 20% of Doctor Who fans have issue with the new Doctor, which is still a sizable amount, but in voices, it's not. And I get it, this is the thing with Star Trek is that they seem to have this fear that they need to capitulate to this, to the legacy of the show, when the majority of people watching that show really do not care where Captain Kirk sits in all this, or whether he's in the same continuity. And sometimes you just think these franchises have just got to let go of these very loud but minority voices. And I know the minority voices do have a ripple effect so far as reception goes, audience reception goes, because they'll be the loud ones sometimes on the internet, but I just generally think they just need to stop trying to capitulate to everyone. I mean,
there's a kind of lionization of kind of Kirk and Picard and the Enterprise, isn't there?
Well, yeah, and that's tenuous enough, isn't it? I mean,
yes.
It's aesthetically speaking, technologically speaking, they're all the aesthetics are all very different, and yet the actual technology isn't horrendously different, is it, over the space of like 130, 50 years? Because they, as we said before, they all sit within the same function. They're there to go out, explore with transporters and similar sort of adversaries. So they all carry the similar sort of motifs. So you're pushing it there. But this just does not in any way feel part of that timeline to me at all. I mean, you can almost vaguely argue that the Enterprise can look a little more like how we expect television to be because it's closer to our sort of understanding of technology. And then you can go, okay, maybe there was a sort of high art aesthetic minimalism that sort of permeated Starfleet in the Kirk era.
Yeah.
That awashed everything with sort of very flat walls, high colour, lots of low lightings and cunt lightings. Okay, we'll just go there, we'll let that roll. And then you go, okay, and then that sort of morphs into something a little more, I don't know, cool. 80s. Well, what was Star Trek? Carpets, I guess. Something a little more plush for the Picard era. So you can sort of try and justify, but this doesn't really fit with any of that. The technology just doesn't really fit at all.
It's closer to the movies, isn't it? The recent movies.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And in fact, you could even argue it's if you took the original series out, which of course you can't, because the aesthetic of the original series has been referenced again in Enterprise and in Deep Space Nine, so you can't pretend that that aesthetic didn't exist, that it's an interpretation. It is literal. That is how it looked at that era in their timeline. If you take that out, the corridors in the episodes 1 and 2 are very similar to the corridors in the sort of militaristic corridors in the original Star Trek movies. So those could almost match, but the original series really makes it difficult to really see a flow in this. And as I say, because they've all made that aesthetic actually literal rather than a sort of interpretive thing, again, it makes it hard to sort of separate it out. And like I said, I mean, this is a different tone. It has a different sort of pace and has a different look. I just don't see why they needed to wedge it into any of these continuities. Why couldn't it just breathe?
Yeah. Okay, well, let's rewind a minute. Star Trek Discovery is on CBS All Actions by Brian Fuller and Alex Kurtzman. It is the first Star Trek series since Star Trek Enterprise, and as we've said, it has a particular place it basically takes place before the original Star Trek series and is apparently separate from the timeline of the feature films that have currently been produced or have been produced recently. And it stars Sonika Martin-Green as Michael Burnham, the first officer of the USS Shenzhou, and later she's a member of the USS Discovery. And the first two episodes, which we're mainly going to be talking about because James has seen them, I've seen the third episode, but like I said, mainly the first two episodes. The first, there's a lot going on, and there is going to be some spoilers in this, so don't shout at us on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. There are some Star Trek Discovery spoilers here. I think watching the first episodes, there's a few things that I feel that are really good, and I think it's probably going to be a good idea to talk about those first, because I have enjoyed what I've watched of the three episodes. I think visually this is absolutely stunning television.
Mm-hmm.
There's space looks great, the ships look great. Everything about the direction and the camera is good. One thing, I think it takes a little bit of time to get into, and that's partly because it's a different way of doing Star Trek. Michelle Yeoh, on the other hand, I absolutely cannot take seriously, I'm afraid. I am really struggling with Yeoh's character. I don't know why. I don't know if it's because she feels wrong or if she feels like she's in the wrong show. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I must admit, my strongest issue at the moment is I don't like any of the characters.
Okay.
Problematic. Bar the slightly tall bridge alien, whose name escapes me. I like him.
Yeah.
But Michael I just don't feel any character there. And I must admit, this is where I feel this Star Trek is like all the other Star Treks, is that it's up to the actor to generate the character. Because really, the characters in the Star Trek shows are really, really quite thin. and sort of archetypal.
Yeah.
Because they always have to be top of their whatever, top of their whatever, top of whatever.
Mm.
That you just see them, that their skills tend to be being top at something else or best at something else. Or, and then you'll have the one character, of course, is the other, who is top at everything but not at the obvious things, who has to find their way to function. And that is basically the sort of paradigm of Star Trek. And it just gets a little frustrating. And I'm feeling it here. And although there are some good things happening here, I'm not saying there isn't, I'm finding that I don't like Michael. Okay. I just don't see any charm in the character yet. And I think that's to do with the actress rather than the actual... Because as I say, these characters have been done before. You know, you could put a young Kirk into her character there. You could probably put a young Picard into her character there. And they'd all do similar sort of things. But it really comes down to the charm of the actor as to how much that sort of motivates you into watching it. And for me, and only me, as I say, I'm not saying this is like some sort of empirical fact, it's not working for me because she is yet to warm to me. I'm just not warming. When she was the face-off with her and Yeo's character, I didn't care who won it. I found both of them irritating.
Hmm.
I found Michael irritating because she was making massive assumptions which seemed to be, as was said, heavily influenced by her massive trauma, which they make a big deal of to show how traumatic it was to her and how it really sort of tainted her. And so she's making these massive risks that seem totally unjustified for anyone to have to get behind, given her background. And then you've got Yeo's character, who is a bit pompously Federation, which is always slightly annoying, which is one of Star Trek's biggest problems. And so neither of them, I was like, I just really don't care. In fact, I'd be quite happy if she shot you, you nerve-pinched her, you both died, and then the ship blew up. And I don't know, perhaps a new ship came along and took on the Klingons, just waiting like a queue of them. It just didn't. She just doesn't do anything for me, and I find that the hardest thing. Sadly.
Okay, that's interesting. I know where you're coming from there. I mean, as I say, Yeo was my main problem. I think I'd largely agree with you about Michael, but I think that she is. I think there is something happens in the third. I'm not saying like there's a big moment in the third episode. I'm saying that there's a bit of development in the third episode which changes things a little bit.
But that's also the problem here is that they've not really had time to characterise yet. It's been pretty much full on.
Yeah.
There was that sort of rather smug and slightly pompous and awkward prologue with them wandering through the desert, which was quite cringeworthy, frankly.
Yes, it was, yes.
Especially how they actually get out of that situation, which made no sense whatsoever.
There was also quite dreadful dialogue as well, which was weird. If I'd have been behind the sofa... If I'd had a sofa to watch it on rather than being in bed, I'd have been behind the sofa with the dialogue alone.
Absolutely. It was cringeworthy, and it looked brilliant. It looked lovely.
Yes.
And the aliens were great, but the dialogue was terrible. And I'm not sold on Yeo either, I must admit. I've liked her in other stuff, but I'm just not getting her in this.
Yeah. Vulcans. Yeah. Not Vulcans. Well, actually, no. Yeah, actually, Vulcans. Because as I said, there's going to be spoilers. So Michael's character has been adopted by... Vulcans, a particular Vulcan family, in fact.
Yeah, and again, this is where it starts to annoy me. I mean, I'm not a massive Trek fan. Again, like it's like we always say, I like to think of myself more of a critic than a long-term critic. You know, if you've read a lot of books, you know, you don't necessarily... I suppose you become a... Do you become a fan of a book, or do you become well-read? I don't know. But, you know, I grew up watching the original series, and I grew up watching the films, and I watched Next Generation, that, you know, because they're on television. And at the time when we were watching television, as old as it sounds, there wasn't a horrendous amount of choice. I'm not so sure I'd be watching Next Generation as I did then, now, given what else there is on, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
But it always feels like this appropriation into that original series. I mean, Sarek was Spock's father. We all get that. That's fine. But then you have Enterprise, which had to therefore borrow the fact they had to have the first proper sort of Vulcan on the ship. They had to have the first Ponfar. They had to have the first encounter of the Ferengi. They had to have the first sort of... it just felt like they were just taking everything which had been done before. Mirror, mirror had to be done by them first. Rather than doing their own stuff, they had to borrow or pull from what had been done before. And, you know, we'd never heard of this thing with Sarek. And obviously, Sarek's a very private individual. So it's totally acceptable that no one would have heard of this, of Michael, in the years that we see after it. But it just kind of feels again like, why does it have to be Sarek? I mean, the actor, I've seen it, he's in a lot of things, isn't he? I can't think of his name. He's very good. I'm very happy with his performance in it. He's one of the
James
most engaging.
Friend.
James Frayne. He's one of the most engaging things in it for me at the moment. But does he have to be Sarek? It's like, why does he have to be Sarek? Why can't he just be another Vulcan? Why do we need to keep going back to that? It just doesn't seem necessary.
It's like the Time Lords in Doctor Who, isn't it?
Well, yeah.
It just keeps going back to that same thing that really you could probably move away from and just continue telling different stories. And it also means that it's very difficult for you to disagree with where CBS have put the show.
Well, yeah, but you could still put it at that place and say this is its own timeline.
Yeah.
So almost like whatever they call it, the Kelvin timeline is its own timeline. And even there, I still think they didn't need the Spock interference in that. It could have existed and breathed as its own thing. But you could just, I mean, I always say Abraham Lincoln sort of appears in virtually every American television show in some way or another. He's in all these continuities in some form or another. In Star Trek, he was remade and becomes a part of Kirk's combat team in one episode. He exists in all these continuities, but it doesn't mean they all exist in the same continuity. You know, you can have Jesus can be referenced in every continuity. It doesn't mean it's the same continuity because Jesus is in each of those continuities. That's probably a poor example. It's just trying to think of things that they reference in everything. So why you can't have Sarek in this continuity, which isn't related to the other continuities?
Yeah.
You know, why, you know, you can talk about, it just frustrates me that we have that sort of rationale. We don't suddenly see, because Margaret Thatcher is referenced in Doctor Who, thinking, well, that must mean that Doctor Who is firmly placed in our reality, or it's firmly placed in the reality of Spitting Image, or it's firmly placed in... Yes, Prime Minister, or, well, yes, Minister, no, it wasn't even in that. Rick Mayall one, which his name's just escaped
New
me.
New Statesman.
New Statesman. So why do we have to sort of make that assumption? Why couldn't this just exist and have a new Sarek, who's a similar character in the same way that Thatcher is in the same in each continuity, but...
Hitler would be a good one as well.
Well, Hitler's the one. I mean, funnily enough, I often use... To break the ice at parties, you know, there's nothing like a Hitler gag, probably. But in this one case, I haven't used him. And that is definitely an example. Absolutely. That is the prime example, is Hitler. Because Hitler appears in so many continuities, in so many genres. Comedy, science fiction, historical. And then, as you say, just referenced in everything else. Yet we don't assume they're all linked together because of the one character. And it's the same with this. Don't need it to all be one thing, but it is. Okay, so perhaps I'm just rattling on something we can't change. It is meant to be. It just feels like something critically doesn't need to be the case. And if it means a few fans have to stamp and cry a little bit because they're not able to wedge this into a continuity of all the other stuff and then get angry when it doesn't quite fit into that continuity, I'd say that's not a bad thing. They'll get on board with it. We all have to get on board with stuff. I mean, Doctor Who is a big example of that, isn't it? I mean, I obviously with his next 13th Doctor, but before that we had to get on board with Missy, and before we had to get on board with Two Hearts, and, you know, before we had to get on board with Adric. You know, we all have these things we have to just sort of eventually assimilate and accept, like adults.
Okay, speaking of... power mad aggressors, the Klingons this time.
Yes,
there is a famous, and this is just quickly referencing Doctor Who again. There's a quote. I think it's probably Terence Dix. I can't remember. Which basically refers to introducing Davros, which makes it easier for the Doctor to interact with the Daleks because watching Daleks talking is very boring. Which is something that the writers of the first two episodes of Star Trek Discovery don't seem to be aware of, because watching Klingons standing around talking is very, very boring indeed. And they share a quality of the Daleks as well, in that their writing is translated in captions. Their speech is translated in captions in a sort of a unique, well, not unique, but a striking font, much like the Daleks in comic strips. Yeah, these Klingons are dull as dishwater when it... Actually, no, I was going to say when it comes to the talking, but they are generally, actually, they're very dull Klingons, aren't they?
I don't know. I'm mixed with them. Part of me, I agree, those scenes are very long, and I admire them for the fact they haven't done that thing where someone goes, speak in Galactic, or speak in English, because we're in English space, and they go, oh, all right, here we go. And then they talk in English. I admire them, the fact that they've actually tried to... And I think that works in a sense, because it does create a certain authenticity to their world. When you're having to tolerate listening to these long conversations in Klingon, it does feel far more alien than if they had suddenly broken out into English, or when they do break into English. It does give them an identity. The aesthetic, I think, is really nice as well. It's really interesting. I do agree, they're a little long, and it's still... not really nothing we've not seen before, is it? It's the only thing I will say is I could imagine these Klingons building things, which the Klingons from the 1980s onwards, I never understood how they got into space. I mean, could you ever imagine an electrician Klingon? You just couldn't. They just don't exist. Well,
the thing about these guys as well is they do feel, yeah, you're right, they do feel more more visceral and physical, and less like the rejects of a Californian rock band,
yes,
which the Klingons and I suppose to some extent Khan's crew in Wrath of Khan felt like they had escaped from California without the guitars. And there's something to be said for the Klingons of the same era in the same way. But maybe there's more to see from them, but at this stage they don't seem like Klingons, because obviously they're redoing the whole Klingon thing. So there is a larger suspension of disbelief required to accept that these odd looking creatures are Klingons, with their strange spiky outfits. And I think really the only thing that they really retain is the kind of the sort of like the forehead nose thing, which is being accentuated. And the big blade things, whose names completely escaped me.
Batlet?
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Again, it feels like you're having to end up trying to justify pigeonholing this new variant of Klingons into a universe that you shouldn't need to do. It could just be the Klingons. I've been watching, I'm only about 40 minutes into it, I've been watching slowly Spectre, the James Bond, and, you know, there it sort of heavily reminds you, which I never really thought about, because I only sort of half watched the Daniel Craig one, sadly, because I just never have the time. But that is, you know, that is a reboot of an established universe. Suddenly now you're dealing with Spectre, sort of four, five films in, whatever it is. Why they couldn't have done that here, and as I say, if it had been its own thing, these Klingons would be... Because invariably, it means eventually, do you have to suddenly... Are they going to get so anal that they have to show the other Klingons in this universe?
Yes.
And I mean, we're going to have the Klingons from the 60s with a sort of slightly dirty, grubby Soviet connotations to them. I don't know. I mean, the one thing you have said, which has interested me, is the idea of Wrath of Khan and those Khan's crew being sort of Californian surfers, because that kind of has that feel, because they complain to Khan all the way through that, you know, you've defeated Kirk, you know, you have a ship. We could just go off and go on search for the perfect wave. It feels that sort of vibe. They don't want to do what he wants to do. They just want to get to the beach. Yeah. But no, it's... Klingons are just... they're a hard thing to remake. I think the only way I'd have remade them, if it was me, would have actually gone the opposite direction and made them less casty and made them more civilized. Because I still find it hard to... I could imagine these, to some degree, building things just out of dogma, because they seem more controlled. They don't seem less warrior, barbaric warrior. They seem to be more ritualized. So I could imagine through ritual and by building ships. But the old Klingons, I could never imagine one at a circuit board without getting angry within a few minutes and bashing it and then circuit board. You know, their ships must be mega old, the amount of time it must take for them to build them. But that would have been, I think, the direction, because, yeah, I mean, it's a beautiful aesthetic. I like the way they're honouring their aesthetic and they're trying really hard to create this feeling. But those scenes were very long. They didn't really tell you that much. And again, you didn't really get any character out of them. I liked some of the character they're trying to put into the flashbacks of the principal Klingon, but I don't know. There's something about this series which sort of is odd. It sort of goes against some of the norms of Star Trek, which is good, but it still seems to follow some of the norms that you rather wish it didn't.
Mm.
The Federation still feels horrendously pompous and annoying, and to a point almost where you'd be quite happy to see it being destroyed. I don't feel any affiliation with the thing, with the Federation.
Yeah. And you probably should, shouldn't you?
You probably should. I kind of also feel with the Federation, and maybe there's something about this, and you know, Star Trek has always carried a sort of high Americanized values almost. It's not necessarily mapping America as it is, but almost maps what America would love to be, but it can't, because it's not in a position where it can accept the things it would want to be. So it has this sort of superiority to it, because America is very, very proud of itself. It has a very, it's a nation of people who are very proud of their country, regardless of their politics. So it's got this sort of pride in itself, and pride in its values and its constitutional values in Star Trek. You know, that they're all unified, that they are all working together as one, that they are more special, that they can teach other people the way to be more unified and perfect. I mean, maybe saying Americans wrong, maybe it's the idealization of any nation. Maybe we'd be just as pompous and the same if it was England. You know, it's not. But you can see where it flows from the American output. And that kind of gets frustrating, because it almost feels like that, you know, the Klingons are striving for unity, and it kind of feels like that's a bad thing. You know, they really shouldn't be allowed to unify. Yet the Federation can unify, which is a good thing, because of their ideology. And I don't know, there's just something a little... And they do challenge this in the shows. Deep Space Nine challenged it quite a lot, which was good. And this challenged it as well in a few ways. They do make Michael a flawed character, which I do like, that she does, at the end of the second episode, make a massive error of judgment purely out of anger, which she advises against, you know, a few scenes beforehand. You know, with the, you know, we need to keep the main Klingon alive.
Mm-hmm.
And then she gets angry and shoots him. So I like that there is those flaws. But I think that is always the problem with me, is this utopian world of the Federation, to have it so utopian, it becomes boring, as the season one of Star Trek Next Generation discovered. You've got to have flaws in it. And as soon as you inject flawed people into there, you lose the ability of having that cohesive utopia. And it just doesn't gel very well. It feels like that idealized, nationalized dream. And as I say, yeah, it's the Americans. It is. This is the Americans' face of it. But like I said, it's a utopia which I think all our countries would have that same sort of idealized pomposity to, especially Britain. We're as pompous as they come. But it doesn't really feel real. It feels sort of slightly twee because it's so ideologically smug. And
well, also there's a feeling of, oh no, it's them as well, isn't there? It's like, oh god, why do we need to fall back to these, you know, these, as you say, pompous, these admirals, these idiots, yes, who have no idea what's going on in the story. They just turn up, start barking orders, get in the way. Yes, they can be used for, you know, dramatic conflict, but they do just turn into just basically a device, don't they?
They're the Time Lords, aren't they? And this is the problem with all these sort of things, that the uniform, the conformity in Star Trek, unlike the Time Lords, is considered to be the ideal of where we're all striving for. It's the thing that Star Trek promotes as being its big thing, that it has this utopian future, which is brilliant. And that is the thing that a lot of Star Trek fans like to say, that we like to believe that eventually we will be like this. And yet, this is always the thing which is being fought for dramatic struggle by the protagonist, who is based on us, and thus, like we have here, we see this immediate fear of the unknown, which is, of course, validated in the story based on her past experiences and stresses, and yet the pompous Starfleet with its perfect, you know, as you say, its perfect system can't see the wood for the trees because reality is over here. And so we get this kind of feeling, again, it almost fits a little with the sort of American and I say, should we say Western approaches to other nations, this sort of fear that they are, you know, that we can't treat them in the same way that we treat ourselves because they're going to destroy us. And maybe some would be like that. But it, you get this weird sort of feeling here that what Star Trek's proud of is something which the story can't let the internal show be proud of. It becomes, like you say, the challenge. And I find that sort of slightly frustrating. Because, it's the same Battlestar Galactica, that first episode, you know, where they're suing for peace with the Cylons, which, of course, you should never do, as the, you know, the main, as Adama says, because the Cylons will destroy us. It's like, no, because we're now peaceful now. And, of course, boy, are they wrong, and the mass genocide occurs. And it's just that weird thing that you promote this positive world, and yet, at the same time, you're constantly undermining it as being trivial and stupid because it can't possibly happen. As soon as you'd have it, you know, you're weak. It's a really weird thing. Federation is strong for being perfect, but it is weak because of it. And there is the same thing here. It's the same thing. This is very much more like Deep Space Nine sort of vibe, isn't it? This discovery. Yeah. That sort of, which is interesting, and it'll be interesting to see where it goes. And like I say, I'm quite critical of it because I don't think it's... I somehow feel that its flaws come from the fact that it's Star Trek, which is probably a bad thing.
Well, yes.
The Star Trek elements to it are the flaws.
Yeah, there is a bit of that, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah, the Klingon flawed in the Federation. Maybe the Federation should have been kept well out of it and had them on the frontier.
Yeah.
Maybe that would have been more interesting. Maybe that's why I like the original series so much, is because they couldn't afford really much other than the Enterprise. You really felt that you only dealt with the Enterprise. You weren't waiting for Federation backup all the time.
Yeah. And subspace communications with the Federation headquarters and all that sort of stuff.
Yes.
Which happens in virtually every episode in The Next Generation, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Well, Star Trek Next Generation really bored me when it first came out because I was so used to the original series. And it just felt to me like, especially the first few seasons, was basically they tended to be like a bus service. We're ferrying Ambassador to sort of Arnold 7, or, you know, where we're taking vital supplies to Trixie R6, and, you know, you feel like, oh, it's boring. I want you to be on the frontier. I don't want you to be a cargo ship.
A bus,
yeah.
There's a couple of interesting things to talk about still. This series of Star Trek concludes next year, but it's been split up into two. So this first chapter, they call it, ends in the first week of November. I think it's the 5th of November. And then it resumes in February. There's a few shows doing this at the moment. I've been watching The Tick on Amazon. And they're doing the same thing. They've got a run of episodes, much shorter episodes, only like 25 minutes. Classic adventure series length episodes. And then they continue again next year.
You know why they're doing this?
To maintain the subscription.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's inevitable that it would happen. I'm surprised it hasn't happened sooner.
Yeah.
Do you want to explain that to people? Because it might... I'm not saying...
Yeah, so basically, if you've taken out the subscription to watch a show, you're not going to get the full run. You're going to have to maintain your subscription through to... You don't have to maintain it. You might stop it and then restart it. But they're kind of banking on you forgetting to stop it because it's not worth stopping it and restarting it for like 3 months or whatever to continue it when the second half of the series starts.
Well, a lot of these shows, I mean, as I think we said this the other week, are gateway shows. They're shows that they're being made, that are being commissioned to be gateways for you to subscribe to a streaming service that you will then you'll use the whole thing and you'll stay with them. So they lead you in and then you stay with them. But if you're having a gateway show which leads you in for a month, you binge your way through. And then you just cancel your subscription because the model now is becoming more and more about monthly subscriptions. The Amazon model has been proved to be less popular, the year subscription. You've got to find ways of trying to keep people with the subscription without it just being about that one show. And I think this is quite a clever way of doing it, because not only does it mean you extend the length someone has to watch that stay with that subscription, stay with that show without having to make extra episodes. So you say you go from October into next year. And as you say, some people might unsubscribe and then resubscribe, but few people will. I think there's always that fear that once people unsubscribe, they'll go and get picked up by the next subscription service, which is offering something in December. Mm. You know, you're hoping that if you split it up like that, that maybe that they'll also get into your content as well and you'll stay with you. So I think it's quite a clever way. I think there's risks in it. Because if the distance is too long, I think people will unsubscribe if they're not that thrilled with that gateway series or the rest of the content. But I think it's interesting, like you say, that they're trying this. I think you're right. I think that's what they're doing. I think they're trying to stretch out the length that you'll subscribe to a channel for.
Yeah. Now, you do touch on something there that I also wanted to mention about people not being thrilled, because... Now, if you're a listener to this in America, you'll know a lot more about this than I do. But it's kind of world news that there is a kind of take-a-knee protest that's been occurring at the NFL. And various parties have been jumping on the take-a-knee bandwagon. And, you know, that is really what it is. Now, the problem with this is that NFL viewers are in massive decline over the past sort of 6 or 7 weeks. Which is, a lot of this has been blamed on this whole Colin Kaepernick protest thing. And last week, the Star Trek Discovery team, all the stars, decided to join in. And a lot of people have been quite vocal in their condemnation of the Star Trek cast for getting involved. And it does make me wonder whether, you know, if you've got a subscription TV service, do you really want to... piss off perhaps, I don't know, half of your audience by joining in with a protest which your audience does not agree with?
I think it's, well, I mean, it depends on what you believe in the right. I mean, if you go, it's like you say, it's like if you said, well, let's anything that is worth believing in does not necessarily have majority consensus. Yeah, I mean, sure. If you take protests like not sitting at the back of the bus, for example, you know, if you take protest, and this is why referendums become are becoming a worry, because they're becoming a very ballsless way for politics to not have to deal with serious issues, because inevitably majorities will tend to be the ones that you want to hold as majority, whatever majority says. You put the majority opinion into other people's hands, and you wash yourself of the blame of whatever goes on. And we see, you know, there's an argument that could be happening with Australia with some of their rights movements at the moment, especially if you know the majority are not for the progression. And like, let's face it, you know, as I was saying, you know, 50s, 60s America, there was not a majority for a lot of racial rights. But it doesn't mean it wasn't the right thing to push forward. And, you know, I think, you know, there are a lot of issues in America at the moment, and a lot of issues over equality and over subjugation and all sorts, which need to be aired and talked about. And there's this old right-wing argument that if you do it in the wrong way, you'll just irritate people and they won't actually engage. That is a tendency to sort of say, well, we'd far rather just not talk about this and keep it under the rug where it belongs. I mean, the NFL ratings can be a lot of things. I mean, there's been a lot of stuff going on in the States over the last month or so, you know, a lot of climate issues which have massively caused problems. I'm cautious of assuming that any decline is solely to do with this. I must admit, I think a lot of people do believe or do passionately believe in these sort of things. I would be cautious in assuming that it is bandwagoning. I'm sure there are those who will bandwagon.
I'm sure they believe that what they're doing is the right thing to do and is appropriate. I personally think with a situation that has already proved divisive, whether, you know, publicly, when there's, you know, there's 13 or 14 of you publicly joining one side or the other, when you're on a subscription TV channel and you're in the first series, that doesn't seem to me to be a sensible course of action.
Well, it's that difficult argument, isn't it? Is that, you know, and it goes down to the core of Americans' First Amendment, really. You know, how far does freedom of speech go? You know, are you allowed to be vocal in your workplace, per se? Is that a place where you're allowed to option freedom of speech, or whether that has to be constantly outside your workplace? And I suppose that becomes very difficult to sort of find your boundaries there when you have politicians who will vocalise their freedom of speech without it being specifically to do with specific agendas or specific political acts that they are in the process of making. You know, should they be making political comments unless it's to do specifically with a particular political strain that they're having to deal with at that time? You know, I don't know what the answer is there. I kind of imagine the problem is that you've got you do have a multiracial cast, which is great for Star Trek, and you've got, you know, there's a lot of feelings that. And there's a lot of fear, I suppose, in America as well. There's a lot of people wanting to stand up and try and get their voices heard. And I don't know, you know, to be honest, there is such a strength, there is such a now domination in our media industries of consolidation, of oligarchies, of commercial and commercial agendas that does make it an uneven place to some degree. I mean, people talk about the liberal elite media, and the media itself is not particularly liberal, but, you know, creatives tend to be a little more progressive and left wing maybe than right wing. So it balances out to a bit. But when you've got such, I mean, how much of American media and how much of British media is slanted towards the right? Maybe you do need these little pockets of people making expressions to try and balance it up. And these days, for right or wrong, celebrities don't have that cash that they used to have with people. I seem to see far more people saying, why are you saying this now? You know, you don't, you know, why are you talking about me? You're rich. You shouldn't be talking for me. That seems to be a far bigger thing than, say, back in the 80s and 90s, where celebrities did have a lot of capital with people. They could sway debates. So I don't think that this sort of act will necessarily sway people, but I think making statements is good, I guess. I think people should feel free, as long as they're not there to incite hate or stir, well, that, I guess, is, yeah. Don't incite hate, I suppose, is the main thing. Otherwise, sure. But it is an interesting point, and I'm wary of my own political bias, because there'll be times where I'm sure I've seen some right-wing things said, and I've thought, well, you know, you shouldn't be using your platform to
it
do
certainly
that.
Works. Oh, it certainly works both ways.
And I think of Bill O'Reilly as an example. But then, you know, maybe I'm more forgiving of people like John Oliver or Stephen Colbert. I don't know. But yeah, no, it's certainly an interesting thing, and I don't know whether it's to do with the decline or not, but I think what is interesting is that celebrities don't have that cash that they used to have. I mean, you think over here that, you know, when Labour won in, what's 97, there was a massive string of high value celebrity endorsement from musicians to comedians to celebrities. And that did seem to give them momentum, to use an unpopular phrase.
Yes, I think it worked to the benefit of both, didn't it? And I think that's maybe because it's now seen to be tainted, isn't it? I think that's maybe why it doesn't happen so much, or doesn't have the same effect now.
It doesn't, does it? That's what's interesting. And as you say, I mean, I think what is interesting there is that celebrities, to use the word, show expressing opinion does not carry that same cash as it did. And I would be interested to know if they realise that, if that sort of culture realises that, or whether they don't care, which is what I hope.
Well, there's so much media now as well, isn't there? There's much more media than there was 20, 30 years ago.
Yeah, so absolutely.
They have to be seen to be having an opinion on something in order to get noticed in whatever publication they're appearing in.
Yeah, there is that. There is that argument as well, that there is a need for more. Crass is a bad word, but there could be a need to take advantage of particular things to, as you say, to get yourself some form of spotlight. That is true. That is true. I mean, I tend to think, I mean, if we look at social media and you look at how many people on your Facebook page or one's Facebook page will express opinion on issues quite avidly and constantly. You think it does seem to be in our nature, regardless of our whether we're celebrities or whether we're the little man or whatever you want to call us, or the normal man or even the better man, who knows? We all seem to have this need to express. So I see no reason why a lot of this would just be that same need, but just with a bigger stage, if you see what I mean. But at the same time, I think we've all known of celebrities, or we've met celebrities who are clearly very in their own bubble and think that they are, you know, that they are very, very aware about keeping their own profile. So like everything, I think there's, you know, greys, isn't it? But yes. I think with this sort of issue, I think this issue for America specifically is obviously a very high tension one, which I can understand why people might feel the need to voice, whatever their level. But that's the problem with the Constitution, isn't it? As soon as you've got in your Constitution that you have the freedom of speech, is you can't turn to these people and say, get back to acting or get back to comedy, do what you're meant to do, don't get political, because your Constitution says that is your right, whatever your level. So it doesn't stop people tweeting at the top, so there we go.
So that's that side of things. Going back to the series itself, you're obviously up to episode 2, so you haven't seen episode 3 yet. There's a nice trailer at the end of episode 2, though.
I didn't watch it.
Oh, you didn't watch it? Okay.
I
forget that.
I tried not to be spoiled.
Fair enough. Episode 3 introduces Jason Isaacs' character. I was sat watching the first two episodes waiting for Jason Isaacs.
Yes, I was surprised about that. I mean, I must say, I really like the way they've done this so far, as adopting that sort of Netflix model of making this a progressive storyline, a la Daredevil.
It's like the old shows, the ship was on the adventure, isn't it? And taking the characters with you, whereas this feels more like Michael's on the adventure taking the ship and the other characters with her, in a way. There's more of a focus on her as a central character than there has been in previous Star Trek.
I think, really, the strength of this series will come later on when we actually see other characters, or maybe you're seeing them now in episode 3, and how their dynamics build. Because I think with Star Trek, what was always interesting for me was it wasn't just Kirk, it was Kirk and Spock, or Spock and McCoy.
Yeah.
And I'm sure later people found the same with, I don't know, Picard and Data, or Odo and Quark. You know, it's about relationships, interaction relationships, and
not Picard and Wesley.
I don't know. I suppose thanks to Will Wheaton, Wesley has now got a sort of newfound capital that I'm sure Matthew Waterhouse wishes he could have found. But you know, Will Wheaton has made Wesley a little cooler than he ever was before, and he would have been long since loathed and hated if he hadn't given him a little more interest. So watching Wesley now has probably got more engagement than otherwise. But yes, quite rightly, he should have been, he was ejected from the ship eventually, which was good.
Just at the dock rather than into space.
It's been an interesting start. It's been different to what I've expected. I've been surprised that the reaction has been so good, because I quite enjoyed it. I didn't think it was brilliant, but given that the hate it was getting in its build-up, the reaction so far seems to have been fairly positive.
I'm encouraged what I've seen so far. And I've seen the third episode as well, and there's nothing in there that's made me think I don't want to watch anymore. It does feel nice in continuing an anthology like. And I think that's what you want, really, isn't it, these days?
Yeah, it feels like it's a show for a new era, and it feels maybe also that it will give Star Trek fans something which perhaps the films cannot give, because the nature of the films aren't there to give it.
Yeah.
So maybe that's another nice thing about it.
Indeed. So maybe we'll revisit Star Trek next year, perhaps.
Maybe,
Second run of episodes. But until now, take a look at Star Trek Discovery, STD. It's available online via CBS All Access. I dare say it will come to one of the UK satellites.
It's on Netflix as well.
Right, okay. It's on Netflix in the UK. It'll probably come to one of the TV stations. I'd be very surprised if it doesn't. Probably a few years down the line, though. Not immediately, perhaps. That's the end of this week's Beyond Casterbus, unless you want to do any recommendations.
No, although I'm looking forward to the return of Red Dwarf this month.
Okay.
Back, could be interesting. I'm enjoying.
I've been rewatching Ripper Street from the beginning.
Oh. And the ending of that was so nihilistic, I found it hard to go back to Ripper Street, but I would like to.
I will say one thing. We're going to talk about Ripper Street maybe next time, I think, aren't we? But one thing I would say about it is it's amazing how they've maintained the tone of that show across not just 5 series, but getting on for 10 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, it is really quite striking. It feels like the same
10
show.
10 years, that can't.
But the best part of 10 years, I think it's 7 years. But you know, the best part of 10 years, they've kept the tone of that show, and the world pretty much constant, and that's really interesting, I think. But Star Trek Discovery, check it out. That's all from James and myself. Until next time, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.